Good morning, good people. There's a particular way I would like to begin, and we're going to start in the back of the room, and I do know the person I'm going to ask to be first, because I happen to know her name, Yolanda. Here's what I'd like to ask us to do. Starting in the back and coming forward, I'd like each of you to say your first name out loud as you can. All right? Ready? I'm Susan. We already knew that. The reason I did that is because that experience of being called by name and being recognized as a person has a lot to do with why I became a Franciscan. So a little personal story. I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area on the sacred side of the bay called the East Bay. Neither one of my parents were raised Catholic. They had no religious faith. They're both converts, and they were baptized not long before I was born. And so I grew up in a home where the faith had a lot of meaning because they chose it when they could choose it for themselves. And often we would go up to the newly built, or actually when it was being built, San Damiano Retreat Center in Danville. We were up there a lot, and I was the tag-along teenager with my parents. My brother was not at home. He was here at the seminary in Santa Barbara. He went to St. Anthony's. So I'd go with them up to San Damiano quite often, and I was used to being the tag-along teenager with the adult world, you know, and nobody paid attention to me. I was just in an adult world, and I was a teenager, and I probably didn't have much to say. What impressed me and really got me seriously considering the Franciscans, because you need to know, first, I was taught for 12 years, from kindergarten to 12th grade, by Dominicans. You know, the other part of the family from the same time frame in history. But there I was, tagging along at San Damiano, and what impressed me so much was every friar, practically, went out of their way to come up and talk with me, to ask me my name, and that maybe I had something of value to say. That personal touch, as far as I'm concerned, should be a hallmark of the Franciscan way of life. And those of you who have known Franciscans, not all of them are extroverts and who mingle easily with groups of people. However, there's a fair number of them who do, and that has always impressed me about, and I think that comes directly from Francis, who couldn't see the forest for the trees, you know. He truly dealt with each person as a person. So that's my first point, although it's not directly related to the topics I've been asked to cover today. That I wanted to introduce myself that way and acknowledge that each of you is a precious individual with a name. So you were thinking, and maybe I was going to remember them all? No. No, I'm sorry not. Okay, I've been asked to cover Chapter 8 and Chapter 9 of Eager to Love, which is a fantastic book. I'm glad it was chosen. These two chapters, the first one is entitled Lightness of Heart and Firmness of Foot. the integration of the feminine and the masculine, and chapter 9, the legacy of Claire. I am not going to repeat what Rohr wrote. My intention is to supplement those two topics as best I can. I'd like to begin, however, with chapter 9, and I'd like to start with focusing on the legacy of Claire. It's my, I think, probably considered opinion, and it's probably true, that most of us in this room have been exposed more to Francis and his way of life than to Claire. And while I am not a poor Claire, I have been studying Claire off and on for about 20 years. So I think I have something to add to our knowledge of her. And I don't want to leave her to the end and leave her out. So I am going to start with Claire. Oh, yes. This is an image of Claire that actually comes from one of our the congregation, as Anne said, to which I belong, is an international congregation. We started in the Netherlands. Our foundress was a Dutch peasant woman. And then we spread into other parts of Europe, primarily into Poland and Germany. We are also, our largest presence is in Brazil. We have our own a province of sisters and booming in Indonesia, which is a Muslim country primarily. And we have three provinces in the United States and a mission in Mexico. So it's very enriching to belong to a congregation with those roots and those connections. This comes from one of our provinces in Germany, in the western part of Germany, a place called Lüdinghausen. And I thought it was a good image of her. I wanted to have an image of her while I talk about her today. So let's start with Claire. Ready? Okay. Claire lived in the shadow of Francis for a long, long time. For many people, for many years, and even for the poor Claires. While they were trying to live her rule, they probably didn't know too much about her. Thank God for the renewal of religious life that happened about 40, 50 years ago. Because it was in the early 1980s, actually, about 20 years after Vatican II, where Franciscans seriously went back to our sources, as Vatican II suggested we do, and began seriously recapturing our understanding of the original spirit that came out of the early Franciscan movement. Francis and Claire and some of the other early followers. We tried then to tap into that major energy that they unleashed in the world at that time. I'll say more about that in a few minutes, about our part in this, our time. But a little bit about Claire. Claire was born in 1195, which means she was 12 years younger than Francis. Okay? He died at age 44. She died at age 58, which was rather old for those days, which means, if you do the math, that she lived another 27 years after Francis died. And it's not just my opinion. This is held by many Franciscans around the world, that if Claire had not held on to the original Franciscan spirit, which she learned partly from Francis, we really wonder if Franciscans would be around today. At least not in the strength that they are. She held the original Franciscan charism and made it live after Francis's death. She probably heard Francis preach when she was about 15 years old, because we know he preached at the Cathedral of San Rufino in Assisi, and her home was on the same piazza. So that was probably her first connection with him. Around the age of 17, she left her home and joined Francis down on the plain below Assisi. And it was there that we don't know whether, we think, you know, Francis was kind of surprised that now he had a woman to take care of, you know. So he provided for her, eventually placing her at San Damiano, which is one of the churches that he helped restore earlier, and she lived there the rest of her life, approximately 42 years. Now, Rohr does a big thing about how she struggled to keep this, what she wanted was, and it seems kind of strange to put these two words together, I'm going to try and say a few things about what it means, the privilege of poverty. I don't know how many poor people think it's a privilege to be poor, but that was her conception. That's what she wanted to live as, by, for. And I want to say more about the context of the time and fill out the story that somewhat Rohr tells. Claire had been at San Damiano approximately 3 years when the church fathers called the Fourth Lateran Council. It was like, you know, we had the Vatican Council 50 years ago. It was that kind of thing. One of the main reasons it was called was to address the problem of women. Are there echoes of recent times? What was the problem? The problem was that groups of women, and not just the Clares, there were other groups of women forming, living together, trying to follow a gospel life. Talk to Judith about the Beguines, who were further north and doing similar things. The problem was these women were forming groups and living together without any protection from the men. Right? No men were in charge. Oh, dear. So the Fourth Lateran Council came up with what they considered the solution, and they told all these groups they had to live by the Benedictine rule. Benedictine rule was tried and true. It had been around for a few centuries, and that was imposed on Claire. Well, if you look at the Benedictine, it's a beautiful rule, and it's a beautiful way to life. It's just not what Francis and Claire were called to live. But here it's being imposed on Claire. Okay, yeah, Benedictines did live, many of them, a cloistered life, but they lived in these huge monastic settings with land holdings. Can't you see Francis going for that? No. And even some of them had their own armies for protection from brigands and robbers. No. This is not something Claire wanted to live, but it got imposed on her. Then one of the early cardinals of the time, Cardinal Hugolino, who later becomes Pope Gregory IX, he was considered the cardinal protector of the friars and also of the Clares. And so he tried to mitigate a little bit of the Benedictine rule for her, and he wrote a rule for her. He wrote a rule for her and gave it to her. The only problem was, one of the problems was, it was based on masculine spirituality. It said that the way to God was to shut down emotions and sense experience. You're telling an Italian that? First of all, even culturally, that doesn't work. Sorry. I lived in Italy. I know how passionate those people can still be. A veil must be worn at all times. All times. Grills were mandated to keep the women protected from the outside world. Or was it the other way around? Strict silence was imposed. And Claire saw all of that as oppressive. So what did she do? As you can probably tell, I think, from the spirit of our current Pope, there's a way that Franciscans approach conflict, and it's not a frontal attack. Both Claire and Francis had reason to be upset with the church that tried to get them to live certain ways. And instead, they just went and lived the way they felt called to live. They didn't make a big issue out of it. As Rohr often says, the best way to be critical of the current situation is to live some other way. You know, that's one of his favorite things to say. So here's Claire doing the same thing. She did see the church, the hierarchical church, as a partner in discernment. So she wasn't going to shut them out completely. She did what every good woman knows on how to get to the heart of a man. I invited him to dinner. We know that works, ladies, don't we? Yeah, most of the time it does. She invited him to dinner, and we are told that he fell in love with her. Now, who wouldn't fall in love with a woman who's deeply in love with God and was probably a very beautiful spirit? He may be a hard-nosed church man, but he knows some holiness when he sees it. So that's just a hallmark of how she dealt with this what we would probably consider a pretty problematic situation. I'd like to do a little bit of an aside for a moment, if you just let me step out of the Claire story for a moment. I would like to draw a parallel, because this brings us up to date more, with what happened to her in that kind of situation, and what happened with us meaning Franciscan sisters, our congregations of active religious women, what happened to us in the 1980s. As I said a few moments ago, we did go back to our sources, and some people don't understand that it was the first time that a lot of those early documents were translated into English and made available to all of us. It's sort of like the freedom we got when Vatican II said, you know what, you can read the Bible. You know, you don't need a scripture scholar right at your elbow all the time. So we went back and we read the original documents, and we're capturing some of the spirit, I think a better understanding of what Francis and Claire were really all about and the way we were meant to live. And then the other thing that pushed us along, in 1983, the Vatican published, here they go again, right? The Vatican published a document after these years of experimentation, living in new ways in religious communities. They published a document called The Renewal of Religious Life for Apostolic Religious Communities. We thought that meant us. We read it. We thought of ourselves as apostolic. We were out in the world doing, we weren't cloistered. We were out in the world doing all these ministries. We were apostolic. But we read it, and there was a huge disconnect. It was like, wait a minute. This doesn't describe very well at all the way we live. What's the matter? Something's the matter. Something's out of whack here. In fact, some of the friars of this province, the St. Barbara province, namely people like the few scholars we have from this province, Father Joe Canici, Brother Bill Short, and Father Michael Guinan, scripture scholar, they credit the fact that some of the sisters of my congregation were the first to raise that question of there's something the matter here. What the Vatican is saying doesn't jive with what we understand as our way of life. They credit us with raising that disconnect, and then they more seriously went back and looked at the original documents, and they came up with the fact, we have a new name for ourselves. We're not apostolic. Francis never wanted his friars to be apostolic. Neither did he want them to be monastic. We have this other thing that's sort of a hybrid called evangelical. Now, don't let that word scare you. And it has lots of meanings out in the culture. But the Franciscan way of life is meant to be evangelical, which comes just simply from the word for living the gospel. That's the first line of Francis's rule. The brothers and sisters are called to live the gospel way of life. Okay? I can say more about that later in the difference between that, or among that, and apostolic and monastic, because we thought we were some of those other things, but we're not. That's not what we're called to live. We're called to be to what's called the evangelical way of life. And there has been a lot of beautiful writing done about that since the 1980s. It put a big shot in my arm to renew my living of the Franciscan way of life when that happened. And it was in 1982, I went to Rome and lived in Italy for 3 years and went to Assisi every chance I got. So that was all coming together for me at the same time. That was kind of neat. But back to Claire. In 1235, this Cardinal Hugolino, who was still very enamored of Claire and wanted to be of help, sent his revised rule that he tried to impose on her to a lady far away, Agnes of Prague. Think of how far away Prague is from Italy. It's quite a distance. But Agnes was born into royalty, was supposed to marry Frederick II, said no, started her own group of women. Ah, another group of women without a man around. And so she was a little uncertain about how she was to live. And Ugolino said, well, here, I gave this rule to Claire, so I'm giving it to you. Well, Agnes read it, and same thing. You know what? I don't think this is it. So she writes to Claire. The reason I mentioned, I could have left this piece out a bit, but I want to mention this because we have, from the hand of Claire, only five documents, for sure. There are some others that are disputed that she wrote. Her rule, we're quite sure she wrote that, and four letters that are still available to be read that she wrote to Agnes of Prague. And in those letters, she truly, you see her soul. You see how she understands her way of life. She talks primarily about following the poor Christ. Oddly enough, Francis and poverty often go together in people's minds that he was a very poor man, the little poor man of Assisi. But if you look at Francis's writings, the ones we're sure of, and you look at Claire's writings, the ones that we're sure of, actually she writes more about poverty than he does. The word that he uses most often and he writes about is obedience. Interesting. So anyway, I wanted to mention those four letters of Claire. You can get copies of them, and they're truly beautiful. And we are going to look at one little piece of them in a few minutes, one little piece of one of them. So now we're coming to near the end of Claire's life. She's been living a particular way, not the way the popes and the cardinal protectors and, you know, she was just living her own way. And they pretty much allowed her to do that. I'm sorry, I missed one thing I wanted to add. Okay, so Agnes was unclear about her way of life, so she wrote to Claire for clarification. I had to add the pun. Thank you. So Claire had been living her own way of life for about 38 years, and she probably had an idea that she was coming near the end of her life, and she wanted her rule written down, so she wrote her own rule. She wrote her own rule in about the year 1250. She died 3 years later. She's the first woman in church history to write her own rule. Now, you might think that would be enough. No, she wanted assurance. Remember, she still considers herself a member in good standing of the Catholic Church, and she wanted the approval of the Vatican for that rule, and that it would be approved in perpetuity. She got it on her deathbed. Pope Innocent IV, by the time she was dying, finally sent a letter claiming that the Vatican would forever allow the Clares to live by Claire's rule. And at the heart of it, this is her legacy. At the heart of it is this living the privilege of poverty. What does that mean? It means living without any consistent means of support. I hope in all of this you can maybe see a little bit of one of the things that Rohr mentions in the chapter beforehand. Claire is a good example, although he's not trying to prove this to us, but Claire is a good example in my mind of integrating the masculine and the feminine herself. Lightness of heart. You know, she deals with the Vatican, she invites him to Ugolino to dinner. It's kind of a light way of dealing with the problem. And it bore fruit. Firmness of foot. She held out for that rule to the end of her life. That firmness of foot. So Claire's legacy is holding firm that gospel ideal of living poverty. The Clares to this day do not have a safety net. They rely on the support of benefactors primarily for the way they live. And believe me, if you know the Clares here in town, they live very poorly. By choice. Of course, when you live like that and you have this way of life that without interference from anyone, then you don't get interference for the most part. They've been left alone to live that very particular way of life. The other thing I want to mention about her legacy is that, in my view, Claire lived the interior life of living the virtues, which Francis also lived, but he lived it in a more external way, actively engaging with the larger society and those he encountered in his many journeys. Now, Francis was on the go a lot. When I lived in Italy, I don't think there was any little town I went to where someone wanted to claim Francis slept here, you know. But it's also true, and I don't know if, I can't remember if Rohr mentions this in the book, but this was news to me a few years ago. Thanks to the scholarship that I've already mentioned that's been done on the life of Francis and Claire, it's pretty certain that a good bit of the years of Francis's life, and remember, he only was converted in his early 20s, he lived to be 44. He kept every year 5 Lents. How long is Lent? 40 days. What's 5 times 40? 200. 200 days out of 365. That other time was the time he was running around Italy and to Egypt and all those other places he went. Francis lived a lot of his time in caves and in contemplation. That was a revelation to me when I learned that. I think we need to hold on to that. He lived a truly contemplative life a good bit of the year. How do you like that? So, what I'd like to do for a few minutes is, okay, there are handouts on the chairs, but you're not all going to get one necessarily. In the interest of money and paper, I made one for 2 people to share. Oh my goodness, sharing, it's a great Christian concept. Okay, so would you like to, I want to draw your attention to something on it. If you could take a look at that, please. Okay, I'd like you to find page 2 that has a picture on it, and I'll get back to that picture later. But I'd like you to look at the words below it. Look at the words below it, please. These are words from the 3rd letter that Claire wrote to Agnes of Prague, who, by the way, is a saint since 1989. She was in 89. Agnes of Prague, who'd been a blessed for years, became canonized, so she's Saint Agnes of Prague now. I'd like us to look at these words of Claire, and we're going to pause for a moment and maybe have a few moments of quiet reflection and contemplation using these words. Before we do, I want to draw out one more thing from these words alone. They almost sound contemporary if you look at them. You'll notice she starts out saying, "Place your mind before the mirror of eternity. Place your soul in the brilliance of glory. Place your heart in the figure of the divine substance." What I want to say about that is this. The Franciscan way of life is known for more emphasis on the will and making choices. The other half of the family from the same time, the Dominicans were always focused on the intellect and knowing a lot. Think of how much Thomas Aquinas wrote. Right? Knowledge was very, very important. Franciscans are sometimes, we're joked about because we don't have any great scholars. Well, that's not quite true. We tend to be more heart people than head people. And here Claire is saying, take your heart and place it someplace. Take your mind, place it there. Take your soul, place it there. Make that choice, be there. Stay there. So I'm going to read this slowly and invite you to look at it with me, and then we're just going to have a few moments of quiet. Is that all right? Okay. From the words of Claire from her 3rd letter to St. Agnes of Prague. Place your mind before the mirror of eternity. Place your soul in the brilliance of glory. Place your heart in the figure of the divine substance. And transform your whole being into the image of the Godhead itself. through contemplation. So that you too may feel what his friends feel as they taste the hidden sweetness which God himself has reserved from the beginning for those who love him. It's my hope that in the future you might return to those words, because for me they're some of the most beautiful words she wrote. Okay, now I want to turn the page and go back to the topic of chapter 8, which is entitled "The Integration of the Feminine, the Masculine, Lightness of Heart, Firmness of Foot Are the Images That Rohr Suggests We Consider in Looking at That Integration." The word integration means to make whole, to put together, to unite. I want to begin with a joke, something I don't usually do. But I found this and it fits, so bear with me. A pastor of a church had previously been a sailor, and he was aware that ships are addressed as she and her, right? He often wondered what gender computers should be addressed. To answer the question, he set up two groups of computer experts. The first group was composed of women, and the second of men. Each group was asked to recommend whether computers should be referred to in the feminine gender or the masculine gender. They were asked to give four reasons for their recommendations. The group of women reported that computers should be referred to in the masculine gender. Why? Number one, in order to get their attention, you must turn them on. Number two, they have a lot of data but are still clueless. Number three, they are supposed to help you solve problems, but half the time they are the problem. And number four, as soon as you commit to one, you realize that if you had waited a little longer, you could have had a better model. The group of men reported that computers should be referred to in the feminine gender. Reasons? Number one, no one but the Creator understands their internal logic. The native language they use to communicate with other computers is incomprehensible to everyone else. Even your smallest mistakes are stored in long-term memory for later retrieval. And the last one, as soon as you make a commitment to one, you find yourself spending half your paycheck on accessories for it. You know, while that chapter 8 is not specifically about the relationship of men and women, I chose to share this with you because of its humor. And we laugh because there's truth to it. There are clearly differences between the way women approach things and the way men approach things. We've all, by this time in our lives, learned that. And I hope that to some lesser or greater degree, we have all come to recognize in our own lives the power of the anima, which is the feminine energy in each of us, and the animus, the masculine energy in each of us. One very worthy goal of the spiritual life, of human life, is the integration of those energies so that by the time Sister Death comes, we will be more whole. We will be more whole persons. So on the handout, if you would find the red writing, it's on the back underneath the bibliography. I gave you a bibliography, and I'll hopefully say a few words about that later. But if you find the print in red, this is how he describes why he chose those two images of lightness of heart, firmness of foot, what it means in his mind. Happy and healthy Franciscans seem to present a combination of lightness of heart and firmness of foot at the same time. By this I mean that they do not take themselves so seriously as upward bound men often do. Yet they do what they do with quiet conviction and full purpose, as mature women often do. We've already seen Claire as a good example of that. And then if you need to have a clear understanding of what's the difference between the feminine principle and the masculine principle, I included some there. The feminine principle has more interest in the inner life, the descent of the soul, the formless, deeper feeling, intuition, connections, harmony and beauty, and a more diffused awareness. The masculine principle, which is just as valuable, it has more interest in the outer, the mental, the form, the idea, the movement or action of things, naming and differentiation of things, ascent of spirit and mind, and a more focused awareness. Two saints a few centuries later are a good example of this. Teresa of Avila, one of her greatest writings was called The Interior Castle, right? Interior. Her cohort, John of the Cross, wrote The Ascent of Mount Carmel. See, I mean, it worked there. Here's a man writing about ascent, and here's a woman writing about the inner life, the interior life. I've always found that fascinating. Okay. So something more about how Francis integrated the masculine and the feminine. There's help here for us, because we live in years after the writings of Carl Jung. Jung is very helpful in this arena. he believed that one of a male's, tasks was to become conscious of his feminine energy, which in religious language is often called soul. Feminine energy, soul. The inner, wherever that is, inner life, the soul. But before that can happen, Jung suggests, a man gets to know his anima, the feminine energy within him, by projecting it onto women in the outer world. So I want to say a few things about three women who were important in Francis's life. There were actually more. I'm not going to mention Mary, the Mother of God. He writes beautifully of her. We'll leave her aside for the moment. I'm going to leave out Lady Jacoba, just in the interest of time, another woman he knew, a Roman noblewoman whom he stayed with whenever he was in Rome. But I want to focus on three women. Two really existed. We'll get to the third one. That's maybe the more interesting one. Francis had three women who influenced his life and helped bring forth out of him that anima, that feminine energy. First we want to mention is his mother, Lady Pica. We believe she was from Provence. I know if I say that right, in France. Francis's father, Pietro, was one of the new rising entrepreneurial classes of that class, and he went to France often. He was a cloth merchant. We're assuming that he met her there and brought her back. Not too sure of that, but we know she was French. And where she was from, in Provence, that was the land of the troubadours. Does your heart warm when you think of troubadours and those beautiful songs they sang, often in honor of their lady love, whether she was attainable or not? Right? And so we believe Francis learned the ideals of courtly love, which were also a part of his time, and that was becoming more alive in Italy, but also from his mother. His spiritual quest is marked by those kinds of ideals. I'll get to this lady last, but we know he courted Lady Poverty. Lady Poverty was a lady to him. We'll get to that. But he also saw in his mother the corresponding masculine energy, and I think he learned it early from her, the ability, the courage to confront social authority. Lady Pica defied the authority of her husband Pietro when she released Francis from the family dungeon or cellar where Pietro had banished Francis because he was upset with him, not wanting to follow the family business, you know. So there's that. And I look at those two things from his introduction to the songs of the troubadours and that way of chivalry from his mother. That's kind of more a lightness of heart, the feminine energy. Then this firmness of foot where she had the courage to let Francis go after, you know, defy her husband and set him free. So there's that kind of firmness of foot. It was in her as well, the beginning of that integration. The second woman in his life was also, of course, we've already spoken of her, Claire. I'm not going to say a lot more about her. He saw the ideal, I believe, of living a life of complete poverty, which he was clearly attracted to. And also, although he didn't live this way a good bit of his life, he saw in her a daily life centered on contemplation and living in love with companions on a daily basis. Now, Francis did have a type of community around him, but we also know that he spent a lot of time in solitude and he traveled a lot, usually with a few companions. But I think he really saw in her that ideal that his heart longed for. Well, and then we know he spent a lot of his time in contemplation. So she was his inspiration in many ways for that. Those two were the outer figures that he related to and through them became acquainted with his anima, that feminine energy. However, the anima also reveals itself often through inner figures, dreams, fantasies like daytime dreams, and prayer can lead a man into that area where he will engage his feminine nature. The feminine is in some ways, well, as the masculine is too, they're archetypes. And they're often buried in our unconscious. That inner figure that Francis then related to is this image of Lady Poverty, and he woos her. He takes her for his bride. There's a lot in the first biography of Francis by Thomas of Celano where he mentions a lot of this kind of thing. The meaning of life was in the attempt to be worthy of her. His life mission was defending this Lady Poverty from all who would demean her. So he fought for living that poor life himself in his own way. one example of this from his own life is, okay, I'm going to leave out that last paragraph. I want to draw your attention again to the handout. If you could please look at the very first page. This was the best description of the books that Rohr mentions in chapter 8. He mentions two in particular. One I had, the one by Leonardo Boff, and I've given you two paragraphs from that piece. I actually have it up here. Francis of Assisi, A Model for Human Liberation. And I'd just like us to go through these two paragraphs because it says more about this integration. I think he does a good job of it. So if you'll follow with me, please. The feminine and the masculine are ontological determinations of every human being in such a way that each individual carries something of both within him or herself. Man and woman form the difference within human unity, but this difference is not capitalized against the other, but rather is opened in profound reciprocity. The male must integrate the anima that gives him strength, that is the dimension of gentleness of care, of attraction, of intuition, of all that is linked to the mystery of life and generation. The female must integrate the animus that is found within her existence, that is, objectivity of the world, rationality, ordering, and direction, everything that is linked to history. In the difficult balance of these two poles, the one solar and the other lunar, the profile of each human person and the wealth of their depth is built. We find in Francis one of the most joyful syntheses that has been developed in Western Christian culture. There is in him all the strength of the animus and at the same time an extraordinary expansion of the anima. Without machismo or feminism, without fragility or rigidity, there blossoms in him harmoniously a gentle strength and a strong gentleness that are the brilliance and archetypal enchantment of his personality. There's been a lot. How many of you saw Brother Sun, Sister Moon, the movie? Yeah. It's okay. It's just that every movie tries to show it something more romantic between Francis and Claire. I'm not sure we want to go there. I'm not sure that's what that was all about. Look at this next paragraph. To understand the gentle relationship between Francis and Claire, it is important to consider the specific meaning of purity that is found in their writings. Evidently, life totally consecrated to God in celibacy and chastity is part of the following of Jesus. There is more to chastity than renouncing marital relationships. For Francis, purity is a synonym for liberty. The only one who is pure is the one who is free of the very attachments of the false absolutes of life, false absolutes of life. Self-promotion, accumulation of prestige, fame, wealth, power, holiness as a personal gain, etc. For Francis, only God is the highest good and all good. He does not allow for any competition of any kind. To find substitutes for God is impurity. To be pure is to be free for the absolute of God. And I firmly believe that Claire lived that way, Francis lived that way, and when they met, there was a beautiful relationship without touch of anything that we would consider less than. They had the fullness. In fact, I don't know if you know of this. There is a story told that one day down on the plain where Claire lived, it looked like there was a fire, and the Assisians from the upper city came running down, and they found Francis and Claire sitting together talking. Their love of God was so pure, they were so on fire that it like caused a fire. Nothing was burning except their souls and their hearts together. So, anyway, the quote on the bottom is by Chardin, and I've had this quote for a long time, and I'm still trying to understand it to some degree, but I think he has his finger on something here, and I want to end with this before we have a break. So if you'll just follow with me that quote by Chardin. No matter how primordial and structural as may be the fulfilling encounter of the sexes, we have no proof that we as yet possess an exact idea of the best functioning and forms of this fundamental complementarity. Marriage is socially polarized on the basis of personal fulfillment and reproduction, whereas religious perfection, theologically, is presented in terms of separation. Men's religious communities live together. Women's religious communities live together. There have been some hybrids tried, and they have not been too successful. So something's afoot here. You know, he's talking about marriages polarized on one side, personal fulfillment, reproduction. Religious perfection is presented in terms of separation. we decidedly need a third way. Not flight by withdrawal, but conquest by sublimation of the profound powers dormant under the mutual attraction of the two sexes. Such is, I am more and more persuaded, chastity's secret essence and magnificent task. I'm still trying to get my mind around what that might mean. And if I've now dropped that in your mind and it's problematic, sorry. We're going to take a break, and there's a box up here if you want to write a question for me. I'm willing also to listen to questions. And actually, I'm going to start when we come back with two questions for you. Okay? So enjoy. Thank you.